You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast.
Number 183, Academia Next with Brian Alexander. Well, that interesting teaser was a song called Don't Doubt Your Vibe by, of all people, Elon Musk. Yes, our real-life Tony Stark. I figured since this episode was all about the future of academia, you know, why not feature a song by Elon Musk, the creator of the Tesla and SpaceX, and now he's delving into making music. It may not be your cup of tea. I tend to like some electronic music, and I have to wonder, is he encoding something in this song? Maybe if we play it backwards, we'll see. Anyway, if you want to hear the full song, Don't Doubt Your Vibe, you'll find it at the end of my podcast. I'm very excited to announce a new sponsor. Today's podcast episode is sponsored by D2L. You may know their main product, the Brightspace Learning Management System. I, of course, would only accept sponsorship from companies and products that I'm very fond of, so please check out their website at d2l.com to learn more. In the interest of full disclosure, my institution, the University of the Sciences, uses D2L Brightspace, and I've been very impressed with their technology. As always, I'm indebted to Inside Higher Ed for featuring the Pulse podcast. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to the things we talk about on my show notes website at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. My topic today is The Future of Academia with Brian Alexander. And the title, as you'll see, is named after his new book, Academia Next. Now, I've interviewed Brian on previous podcasts. My first connection with him was with the Horizon Report you may be familiar with. He was one of the editors. And today he's launching his book, Academia Next. It's all about the futures of higher education. Of course, if you don't know Brian, he's a futurist, researcher, speaker, and educator. His focus is on the future of higher education, especially under the impact of technology. So this is a very wide-ranging discussion. I have a lot of fun talking to him. We discuss all kinds of things. He's now teaching at Georgetown University. Of course, we focus a bit on his new book, Academia Next. We talk about future education scenarios, and he goes out to 2035 and even longer. We discuss technologies with largest impact, next-gen learning environments, mixed and extended reality, gamification, techno-panic, at least I call it that, open education, influence of science fiction, quantum computing, geriatrics, social trends, including policies and politics, cyber warfare, and what our future jobs are going to be like in the education space. So without further ado, here's my interview with Brian Alexander. Well, Brian, thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me again on my podcast. It's been quite a while. For those of my listeners, you might remember Brian from previous podcasts, and he was also the keynote speaker at our eLearning 3.0 conference here at University of the Sciences 2 years ago. So, Brian, what's up with you these days?
Well, plenty of things, and thank you for inviting me onto your program, Rod. It's a real pleasure to be here. Part-time, I'm teaching at Georgetown University in their Learning, Design, and Technology Master's Program, which is terrific. I'm teaching classes on technology, education technology, and the future of higher education, and that's just an absolute pleasure to do. I'm continuing my consulting work, consulting with colleges, universities, businesses, governments, nonprofits around the world, and that includes a lot of speaking, so I'm doing a lot of keynote gigs. I continue to make the Future Trends Forum. In fact, I'm coming to you now an hour after finishing this week's forum. So that's our weekly video conversation about the future of education. And this week, my latest book just launched, Academia Next, which is about the next 15 years or so of American higher education. So that's very exciting. So I've got various parts of book tours, physical and virtual, lined up for the next 6 months. And then I never stop. So I'm working on plans for my next podcast, as well as for pitching my next book to a publisher.
Wow, you have so much energy. I'm very envious. You're doing so much. And if anybody out there is interested in the future of education, you must know Brian by now. If not, certainly get to know him and be looking forward to your book. So why don't you tell us a little about your book, how that came about, and what do you cover?
Well, I've been working on the future of higher education solidly for the past 10 years. And along the way, I've been meaning to contribute to a book, and I've been writing chapters in other people's books and articles and columns and a long-running blog and all of that. But I really wanted to just expand this to book length in order to really dive deeply into the problem of how college and universities will change over the next decade and a half. And that took some doing because it's a very, very complex and large topic. All too often, we treat it as a simple topic. People will only talk about one particular type of university, or they'll only talk about one piece of the problem, such as just technology. And so I wanted to make sure it was a synoptic overall approach to the entire sector of higher education in the United States. And it's been an absolute pleasure to write. Johns Hopkins University Press is the publisher, and they've been terrific as editors and very, very supportive. So part of the book, the first part of it, is what we call trends analysis, where we take a look at present-day trends, and we evidence them by looking at recent history in the present, and we extrapolate from them into the near future. So that's something I've been working on partly through a monthly publication where I take a look at present-day trends. I follow about 90 of them, everything from economics and demographics to policy, culture, enrollment changes, financial changes within higher education, technology, as well as educational technology. So the first half of the book, more or less, is just a deep dive into all those trends. And that's a little unusual. When people think of futures work, they often think of pure speculation or imagination. But this is all grounded in the present, what Amy Webb calls finding signals of the future in the present. And then the second half of the book takes those further and says, all right, well, what happens if these forces come true? How do they change education? What does the college of the future look like? So I generated 7 different scenarios, as well as a chapter just on extrapolation in general. And then I took them, in the second to last chapter a little further forward. Like, what happens over the 20 years after 2035? So this gives us, I think, a lot of ways to think creatively and thoughtfully about the different directions higher education can be headed.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite a big chunk. That is a mouthful. I'd be very excited to read it. I mean, it reminds me a little bit about, science fiction becoming science fact. So you must, have fun just speculating what it might be. And I remember years ago doing a slideshow where I would talk about how educational technology was derived in large part by the, consumer technology, television, way back when, with the film strips and TV and CDs and so forth. So what do you see? I mean, I can certainly speculate myself about a couple of things, but what are some of the things, the current technologies that are sort of on the horizon right now that you think are going to have the largest impact on education?
Well, that's a great question. And if you're asking about largest impact, there's always a question of how we determine this. I mean, some of them are technologies that are very prosaic to a lot of us now. I mean, you think, for example, about the learning management system, which is ubiquitous. And, most campuses have at least one installed at an enterprise level. And that's where a lot of learning and teaching is grounded these days. And how those LMSs change will shape how that learning is done. And right now, the LMS market is pretty conservative formally. There haven't been a lot of changes. The next generation digital learning environment movement hasn't gotten very far. So I'm looking to see how these could alter. We interviewed Phil Hill, the LMS guru, and he said that he thought the next technology for the LMS would be smart speakers, like Siri or Alexa, because they're fairly easy to program the routines into the kind of data that you can get from an LMS. I'm I'm very, very curious about the visualization properties of the whole spectrum from augmented reality to virtual reality, what some call mixed or extended reality, because that's, yeah, visualization is a long-running problem in education. How do you get a student to see the shape of a hurricane or the inside of a molecule or the rings of Saturn or the tombstones of ancient Egypt, things that may not exist now physically or that may be impossible to get to or have scale issues. And so VR and AR have all kinds of possibilities for that. So I find that very exciting. I'm interested in where big data and data analytics go as well. That's not new technology. It's relatively new for higher education, but it's not new to the rest of the world. And in part because there's all kinds of fantastic potentials and uses, but there's also so much opposition within education. Sometimes it's unconscious in the sense of friction, and sometimes it's conscious in the sense of politics, where people are worried about how we use data, how we gather it, who owns it, what the constraints are on it. The British medical magazine, The Lancet, had a really interesting editorial where they said, we shouldn't think of data as the new oil. We should think of it as the new blood. And they didn't mean that in a gothic vampire way. They meant that in the sense that we have lots of regulations around human blood and how we use it, how it's stored and how it's typed, how it's maintained, how we find it, who can donate. I mean, it's really a very, very regulated market of a precious resource. So maybe we should think of data that way.
Interesting. That's an interesting way to, an interesting metaphor. I'm curious. You know, you mentioned VR and AR. I have to ask, are you a gamer? Do you play with these tools yourself?
I am a gamer, and I do play with all kinds of gaming tools. I mean, I find gaming just endlessly fascinating. I mean, not only just fun, but also, I mean, on the biggest picture possible, it's a new branch of human culture. You know, and you don't see that too often. You have to go back to like the birth of radio or the birth of movies for that. And the amount of creativity in gaming is just phenomenal. And it's really, really impressive. When we think about this in terms of education, right off the bat, we have game studies, which is a formal field with scholarly meetings and journals and books. But also we have the different ways that gaming can be used in education, everything from games as a kind of learning object to students creating games. And that's all, I think, very fascinating. But on top of that, we have the kind of second-order impact of games. You know, if you look at your laptop, and it's good enough to have beautiful graphics and sound that we can use now for Skype, it wasn't built for you to use Excel. They were assuming that the typical user was playing games. Games have really driven hardware and software design in ways that aren't, I think, fully appreciated. So even people who can't stand computer games, their environment has changed.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've never been a gamer, you know. I don't know. I've always been just, you know, reading about it, reading about the technology. I use other technologies, of course, but I've never, the gaming that I did, I remember as a activity with my wife years ago was, you remember Leisure Suit Larry?
Oh yeah. Oh, I do.
That's as bad as close as I got to gaming. And it was a lot of fun while it lasted. I just remember having to dial up on my noisy modem. Yeah. And pay somebody for a cheat code in order to get past the next level.
Oh, I remember that. I remember that. You know, I tell my students about that, and they just give me that look, you know, like, let me ask, in the 80s, were you a Mac user?
Initially, I cut my teeth, believe it or not, on Unix, on a, for the time, was actually a Xenix, a Microsoft product that was actually running on one of the larger TRS-80 computers. That's after having Fortran and whatnot. But so really, I was Tristos, MS-DOS first, and then when Max came out, of course, everybody was jumping on that, and I did shortly thereafter. So I'm showing my age.
Oh, no problem. I was just asking because It's always fun to talk about old computers, but one of the interesting things with the development of gaming is that Steve Jobs did not like computer games. And so you had a phenomenon of computer games really being a PC thing. And one of the things that I'm entertained by when I look at games on iOS is how many of them remind me of classic PC games, but they're newer now to a market that didn't fully apprehend them.
That's right.
No, there's all kinds of technology, and you know, I'm a big fan of 3D printing. I've seen some phenomenal creativity from my students, and it also ties into all kinds of larger possibilities in production. You know, it's as a phenomenon. If we can print more and more, how does that change the supply chain for all kinds of stuff?
Some people would say that all this technology is making us more stupid. You know, it's like when you can look up everything on Google. What does that do to our brains after a while? Is there any, do you ever play devil's advocate around that sort of concept?
Yeah, I respond to that with history, but kind of in an unusual way. It's commonplace to observe that, you know, for several thousand years, we've had media critics pronouncing doom for every new medium. You know, you look at, in the 1700s, you had people saying, oh, the novel, my God, it's going to spark social unrest. You know, so you and I are not too far apart in age. We might remember the 1980s panics over role-playing games. And if you go to look at the 90s, the panics about the internet, they don't age well. And they have real impact. I mean, all these panics had real impact on policy and on attitudes. And I think that's a little easy as a method. I mean, that does take care of some of the anxieties, but on the other hand, history also tells us that whenever medium changed our habits, we also scrambled to figure out how to handle it. So we did all kinds of things, like, you know, we changed copyright law, like with movies. There was the debate, we need a copyright film. This is like 1909 I'm talking about. Now, do we consider it to be physical medium? So is film like photography? Or do we consider it to be a storytelling device like drama? So you have to go through those policies. But then we also change our tools. I mean, you think about print was an incredibly destabilizing, wild factor from the 1400s on. And we kept changing how we handled it, you know, in terms of everything from royal licensing of print to the development of technologies and formats like marginal annotations to new forms of writing. From around 1500 to 1700, you could find a Latin book called a Florilegium, which was a kind of synopsis of other books with excerpts from them. And then we invented the encyclopedia. And, you know, you think about indexes and tables of contents. So I think now we're doing something similar where, you know, when we have information overload, we try to come up with new filters, as Glacier says. We try to grapple with things. I would also go back to the calculator. I mean, you and I remember when the calculator took off and there were all these worries that kids wouldn't learn basic math. But we still use calculators. In fact, math classes and engineering classes require the purchase of calculators or they provide them. So I think in many ways we are empowering ourselves. We are treating these as a positive prosthetic to improve our thinking. And that's a really good move. So, yeah, I'm overall very positive.
You know, when I think about education in general, especially in the future and with all the emphasis on technology, then you have to think about the haves and the have-nots and you know, what that's going to do to our culture. For example, I'm sure Harvard and Princeton will have a campus, you know, 100 years from now, you know, probably for the 1% or the 0.1% of the population that can afford it. How do you see technology helping to spread education if people just don't have the means?
A bunch of ways, and some of them I think are not fully appreciated now. So I believe in the open revolution. So in terms of open education resources for teaching and learning and for open access and scholarly publication. And I think in some ways people are not talking about this as much because either it doesn't seem as sexy as it once did, or they just kind of assume it's going to be inevitable. And it may be that within the next 5 years, we see a flip where the majority of educational content or the majority of scholarly content or both are available in open forms, which would be great. I mean, you know, you look at the global south everywhere from, you know, Southeast Asia to Africa, and you see you see libraries and would-be scholars that simply can't get access to this stuff. You know, the founder of Sci-Hub was a master's student in Kazakhstan who kept trying to do her master's work, but couldn't afford to keep paying for individual fees after fee for individual articles. So I think open has a chance to really, really give us a lot more access. I think there are other problems, though. The financial model, this is something I talk about a great deal about in the book, the financial model of higher education is really, really stuck. So in terms of getting content, I think that's easier now. But in terms of the interaction with the instructor, I mean, if I were to take a class in audio production with you, how do I pay for your time? I mean, how do you support yourself? And we've messed up the model for that. I mean, the majority of instructors in the United States are adjuncts now. And yet the costs keep shooting up, both the absolute price and to a lesser extent the discount price. And that's really becoming an almost insurmountable problem, especially when it combines with student debt, which is right now, you know, I mean, the big milestone to think about is when student debt hits $2 trillion. And that's really just astonishing. And it's interesting that almost no country has imitated us. It's kind of like healthcare financing. You know, we had something and it's a lousy idea. So no one wants to copy it.
Yeah, really. Yeah, you bring up a good point about the finances. And I'm just wondering what it's going to look like. You know, you're stretching way out into the future in your book. And I remember the Horizon Report, which has been resurrected. They have always talked about 3 years, maybe 5 years out. So you're talking about even much further. What do you draw upon? Are you an avid sci-fi reader, for example?
I am. I think science fiction is an indispensable tool for being alive in the 21st century. And most countries realize this. The U.S. has been slow to figure this out, which is unfortunate. We helped invent the term in the field. We coined the term. But we've often had a kind of snobbishness. And I can say that because it comes partly from my discipline. My PhD and my first job was being a professor in English literature. And American lit profs are often, they look askance at the low genre of sci-fi. But the science fiction gives us a lot to tell. I mean, there's a whole subgenre of science fiction about education.
Really? I wasn't aware of that.
Do you remember the classic story, Mimsy, Where the Borough Goes? About a couple of kids, little kids, who stumble across learning technologies from the year 3000. There's the apprenticeship or the learning of a student and growing to adulthood is a typical plot. I mean, in German, we call that, you know, the Bildungsroman. And there are a lot of books like that. You think about Harry Potter. You think about Dune. You think about Ursula Le Guin's Great Earthsea series or Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game. You know, there's stories about what happens to students in VR. There's a biologist at Kenyon College named Joan Slonczewski who has a series of science fiction novels, and one of them is about a liberal arts college in Earth orbit. There's Werner Vinge has a really interesting novel called Rainbow's End. One half of it is about a university that's going through a book scanning project for a company that looks like Google. The other part of the book is about a guy who's been treated for Alzheimer's and is trying to get his brain working again, so he has to go back to school. So, I mean, straight up, you can just use that. But also, I think just the idea of thinking about the future creatively and imaginatively, that the future might not look exactly like the present, science fiction really gives you that power. And so I think that's a key thing. But the other, you know, the further out you go, the harder it is to forecast. And one of the other things I look at is I try to look at long-term trends that have a lot of staying power. You know, there's a saying, we tend to overestimate the short-term impact of changes, underestimate the long-term impact.
Yeah, we're still looking for flying cars, you know?
Yeah, there are a couple of projects doing that. And you know, at some point, we might do that. But you think about how many technological visions didn't play out, either because the science was wrong, You know, you think about feeding images directly into the brain. We're still way behind on that. Or because it just became very difficult. I mean, one of the reasons we don't do flying cars is because the traffic is terrible. You know, we ran into this with helicopters. I mean, if you think traffic is bad with cars, just imagine it in three dimensions. And but you know, you think about some trends that might not be as appealing or that might be not quite as visually exciting. I pay a lot of attention to demographics. And we now know it's pretty thoroughly established that whenever a culture goes through modernity, it changes its population structure. And what happens is we produce fewer and fewer kids, and we live longer, so we have more and more old people. And this has happened in every nation on Earth that has gone through this process over the past 100 years. And the U.S. is doing it now. Our population, our fertility rate is dropping. And this is a terrific thing in all kinds of ways. I mean, one of the great stories of the past 30 years is that, for example, teen pregnancy has almost completely vanished. I mean, that was considered a social scourge, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and we solved it. It's just almost completely gone. You think about how one of the reasons we have fewer kids is because more women have more education and more control over their reproductive rights. This is a great advance. And people living longer in part because we've had huge developments in medical science and public health. I mean, this is a triumph for me, a really great thing for civilization. The downside is we don't know what to do. we didn't think this would happen. You know, you look at China in the 60s, some of the Chinese government were really worried about overpopulation. You know, they were the country with the biggest population. So they passed their one child per couple law. A lot of demographers say now the law was a mistake because it didn't really matter. China went through modernity. They modernized, education went out, and fertility fell on its own. And now there's possible worry that they may have a giant population of senior citizens over the next 40 years that they really can't support.
Right, right. And you need the younger generation to support the old. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And every demographer that I've seen, every professional demographer, is a huge fan of immigration. So they're kind of like the anti-Trump. And it's not just Trump, though. I mean, you look at Japan. Japan has aged out really fast, and they are pretty actively hostile to immigration. It's very hard to immigrate into Japan. So Japan is going for robots in a big way.
That's right.
So think about this. You know, what does this do to society? Do you have a couple of writers that I really enjoy came up with the term geriatric peace. You know, they said that if you've got lots of teenage males available, it's easier to go to war. You know, but if you don't, it's harder to. So maybe do we keep having a less violent society, as Steven Pinker suggests? You know, do we change our economy around if it can't be as productive? Do we either extend retirement beyond 65 so people retire at 70 or 75? Or do we just accept a kind of slowdown in productivity? Or we redefine productivity so that, for example, caring for seniors is considered part of GDP. I mean, these are some of the long-term questions that kind of persist when short-term things like, oh, what about the new iPhone? You know, and then you can find other long durée topics like the sheer amount of information that humanity generates continues to grow. Or you think about other technologies as well.
How about quantum computing, for example? I mean, that's
a great example.
If it pans out the way they're talking about it, I mean, that's just it's almost unimaginable what that could lead to.
Well, it's a favorite of science fiction. A lot of science fiction writers like to press on it, and it's interesting. A growing number of science fiction writers are actually computer programmers or have some kind of IT experience. So you think that, you know, would quantum computing end the spate of hacking and cybercrime? Because we can deepen encryption. That would be great. Would it enable real-time communication across the solar system? That would be pretty amazing, you know, to have. Would it let us shrink our devices even further? I mean, so we get to the point where we may no longer have visible or at least easily visible technology. You know, so instead of having a laptop or a desktop or a tablet, what if we basically have grains of rice? You know, that we may lose. Oh, shoot, drop my computer. Where is it? You know, do we have environmental computing where we don't even bother physically touching it, that we control our computer, interact with it just by voice and gesture? whole other computing paradigm, and we see traces of it with some of the mixed reality tools like HoloLens and Magic Leap. And, you know, that's one way forward. The other thing about quantum, though, is that quantum is we're still in the heroic early stages of it. And there are uses and possibilities that may unfold that we haven't seen yet. And that's what I'm really, really looking hard at right now.
Yeah, I was thinking back at, you know, the term quantum supremacy. You know, that sounds so highfalutin, but it really doesn't mean much in the way of, you know, something practical. But it's, I guess it's a proof of concept that, yes, there is quantum computing, and it may take decades before it becomes useful in some way.
Yeah. It may take decades. You know, you think about how AI took a long time to really grow and proceed. You know, or it could be quicker, or it may just be perpetually just out of reach. You know, the joke about fusion power, for example, is that it's always 3 years in the future.
Yeah.
So again, thinking about this in the long durations where we have to think further and further ahead. But I'd move away from technology and science for a minute and also look at other social trends. So, for example, what does it look like if we actually have equality between the genders? You know, that's been a revolution long in the making, and we've made a lot of progress recently. What happens if we have, you know, I'm trying to figure out the duration of this current spate of reactionary governments around the world, you know, people like Modi in India, Bolsonaro in Brazil, Duterte in the Philippines, Trump in the U.S. My hypothesis is that this is epiphenomenal. It's tied into a generation that is already very old. It's kind of last gasp or last hurrah, and then it'll fade. And that's my hypothesis. I'm not sure if I'm right. So I have to investigate that and figure out, you know, do we end up with a kind of blue state world? It's possible. It's possible. Or do we bracket out again? Do we divide? Do we get divides between, say, blue states and traditional societies that plays out across the world? Or do individual nations pick that up? Does something like Hungary or Poland become a hard right country for a century versus, say, a more liberal Scandinavia, for example?
It's supposed to still be that in warfare, you're not supposed to cut the undersea cables, but it just happened recently in Yemen, I believe. Now they say it could have just been a boat anchor,
right.
But people don't, you know, they hear the internet, but they don't, and they think satellites, but it's real, all, you know, these undersea cables and what that can do to a country by snipping a few cables, you know, it's crazy. And, you know, the future wars are probably going to be internet-based wars.
Sure.
If there are wars at all. I mean, you know, I guess this is a bit off topic, but, you know, it's not unthinkable that, you know, China pretty much takes over just slowly, bit by bit, just by, you know, the business environment.
Well, it's a really good question. I don't think it's that far off topic, because when you think about the impact of war and the military on education, it's a very, very deep one. In the U.S., it's changed. If you look at the number of people who are veterans after World War I, after World War II, they're the elite of society. You know, you look at CEOs in the 1950s, you look at congressmen, and almost all of them are veterans of combat. There's actually this theory that one of the reasons for the design of post-war businesses was that so many CEOs were Air Force veterans, and we're used to a literal top-down command and control, if not actually, you know, officers higher up in rank. But since the Vietnam War, we've changed the sociology of that. And now if you look at Congress, it's considered remarkable if someone's a veteran. You look at higher education, and in many ways, we have very little, very few ties to the military. It's rare to see ROTC. It's rare to see military history taught. In fact, most campuses that I talk to don't really hail military students. They don't recruit from veterans. A few do, and they are successful at it. So plus is the connection between research and the military. You know, when research, anything from AI to thermodynamics, you know, to what, when when does that research become part of the military? And that's a vexed and deep question. I think the tricky thing about war now is that there's the question that war is so destructive that fighting it can destroy the object that you want to attain. So if you want to conquer something or obtain a province, then you may destroy it so thoroughly that it's not worth the cost. So do you use information warfare as a way around this? Have you seen, there's a recent documentary about the Stuxnet virus. Have you seen this?
I've heard about it. I have not seen it yet. That sounds pretty interesting to me. I sort of know a little bit about it, but why don't you just briefly say what that's about? Because I think it's a very interesting topic.
Well, summarizing this too quickly, the Iranian government was pushing for generating its own nuclear weapons, atomic weapons, that is. And the U.S. and Israeli governments wanted to block this. So the Israeli Secret Service built a virus that would shut down the particular brand of uranium enrichment hardware that the Iranian government was using in the city of Natanz. The NSA in the U.S. thought this was great, helped it, and got this out there, and the virus went wild, worldwide. But the thing was, it was harmless. All it did was hit this one particular machine. And so finally, when it ended up in Natanz, it shut down and messed up these centrifuges. So it seemed to be a successful case of cyber war. But I mentioned this because of a few things that are interesting about it. I mean, one is that cyber war can be undeclared. It can be done between friends and allies.
It's happening now. Let's face it.
It is, and it's very much in the shadows. It's it's the world of counterintelligence where it'll be years before you find out what happened. But it's also fingerprintless. You know, if a network goes down, a machine gets turned off. You have to guess. I remember a few years ago there was a brief panic because a power generator in Vermont ran into some technical problems. And the locals assumed, oh, my God, it's going to be Russian hacking. And turned out, no, it was just some operator error. Someone just keyed in the wrong thing. And, it's hard to tell. If a voting booth goes offline in November, is it Russian hacking? Is it Chinese hacking? Is it Republican Party hacking? Is it some kid who's having a blast? The higher ed is part of that world. So we are constantly subjected to cyber threats of all kinds of ways. From ransomware to stray attacks. And, this impacts higher ed. This adds to our cost of operations. We have to, as we work, we have to spend more money on IT department staff, along with software and hardware, in order to protect things. You'll appreciate this. Fall 2018, I was teaching a class online through Georgetown University, but I was living in Vermont. And one thing I was trying to do was to authenticate different parts of the Georgetown network. Well, they just rolled out dual-factor authentication, so I was ready to get pinged on my cell phone. Problem was, cell phone reception is horrendous in Vermont. I would have to drive about 30 minutes for that. So we managed to kludge together a way where they could ping my landline. So I think I was like the only person who had a landline second factor authentication there in the university. You also have to think about careers, how cybersecurity is this field that is fantastic. People get hired right away and go to work because the needs are so high. So how much of higher ed should pivot towards offering more and more cybersecurity degrees?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. In fact, one of the most popular courses at a local college here is on that exact topic. So it's certainly growing by leaps and bounds. I know it's practically speaking, you've got to have the people that, and people that we train here locally for our own IT department are often picked off and get paid multiples of what they're earning here to do the same thing at other institutions.
Oh, sure. One of the challenges, as well as one of the pleasures and one of the rewards of thinking through futures, is looking for all these connections across fields and domains. So, we look at cyber crime, which is, a branch of crime and computer science, and then we see how it plays out in career choices for higher education. But then that has other follow-up courses. I mentioned before the financial pressures upon most of higher education. Well, if you're a university or a college, and your budgets are very constrained, and you see this rising interest in cybersecurity studies, okay, you spend some money and hire people, you know, grow a program, maybe add a degree or so on a lab. But if you have a zero-sum budget, what do you cut for this? And that brings us to the decline of the arts and humanities.
Yes.
So, you know, do we see this continued shuffle of resources from one to the other? And if that's the case, then how do the humanities respond? Do humanities become general services departments where they teach a lot of intro classes and a lot of writing classes, that kind of thing? Or do they become like classical studies, a very small, almost ornamental, but very precious place of higher education? So instead of having 50 literature professors, you have five. You know, instead of 20 historians, you have two. So you know, these knock-on effects just keep rippling across the different domains of the issue.
Yes, they do. And with that, I think I want to be respectful of your time. And I so enjoy talking to you. And I could probably go on for another hour or two. But I think our solution is to just have you come back more often.
I think that's a fantastic solution. I would love to hear from folks who get to read Academia Next. It's available from Johns Hopkins University Press, both in physical hardcover as well as in ebook form. You can grab it from Amazon if you prefer to go that way. And I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And I'll certainly have links to the book on my show notes. So congratulations on your book. It's fantastic.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for the opportunity to talk with you. It's always a pleasure for me.
Pleasure for me too, Brian. You take care.
You too, Rod.
Bye for now. Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed my interview with Brian. Don't forget to check out rodspulsepodcast.com for links. And stay tuned for the full song, Don't Doubt Your Vibe by Elon Musk. Until next time, have a great week. We'll be right back.
today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.